What is happening? Welcome to another episode of The Craft. My name is Nick Pollock, and today we have a very special guest. It is Lance Brzezowski of Marquee Sports. Lance, oh my gosh, so great to have you here.
Thanks for having me, man. Yeah, we've been trying to coordinate this for a bit, so I'm glad it manifested.
Months!
Eno just had to go on a vacation or something, I imagine.
Oh, there you go. Right? Thank you so much, Eno. Thank you. I mean, he's a guest, okay? And we have another guest. This is a guest show. Everyone should understand that clearly. Lance, I tell everybody, of course, really quickly, like your resume, your pedigree, everything that you've been doing.
Yeah. It's an interesting life path. I think all of us kind of do in the industry. Right now I work for Marquee Sports Network, which is the Chicago Cubs regional sports network. I'm a talent as well as kind of a video editor, producer. I help them out with a lot of stuff. I do some minor league stuff. Trying to definitely grow on like the TV side. Did some stuff with MLB Network for the draft, which was super cool.
That was so great, man.
It was a lot of fun.
You did such a great job, really.
I love like just bringing out some of the data and being able to like look at shapes of these guys and use that information to actually get it to TV. I think super important. So as you can see, that's a running theme, I think, in a lot of what I do. YouTube channel and Substack are the two things I'm really trying to hammer this year. Substack's just like daily thoughts. Like every night I'll sit down for a couple hours and just rip through stuff, which it sounds like you do as well. And
I love it. It's funny because I don't get it before I write mine, so it's like the next day if I miss something or whatever, I'm like, oh, that one, yeah, okay, there, that was good.
Yeah, there's definitely times where I look and I'm like, oh, I can't believe I missed that. Like, you look through more. I can only have the capacity to do like three guys.
I have to do every single one. It's like I think everyone kind of knows that. That is the real work I do. Everything that you guys see on the content side, it's really just the SB roundup, because that I've covered every single start that every single starter has had this year. Thus, it's in my brain, and then everything else is just reinforcement of it. But I mean, some of this stuff, guys, if you're not subscribed to Lance's Substack, you have to do it. I do it. It's pretty much like the only one, I think, that I'm sub to. I mean, there's one or two others. But I mean, yeah, well, it's just like, yeah, well, this is information that I want to make sure that to be the guy that I am, I need to be on top of all of this. There are obviously certain times where I'm like, I don't know, maybe. Is that a thing? Is that not? You know, but obviously.
Oh, I agree. No. Sometimes when I write it, I'm not sure either, you know?
Yeah. Well, right. Exactly. That's the whole point. And I want you guys to also know that I'm not just giving a blanket endorsement because Lance is here. I'm like, no, this is legitimately great. And y'all should be a part of that. And also, I mean, one of the things that I really appreciate you about you, Lance, is that we're in this age of like, okay, analytics versus not analytics. What do we do? And I think something that we are, having to deal with a lot is how do we take this information? That's all it is. The word of analytics is just this information. How do you condense it into a format that A, is, you know, understood by the listener from all ranges, and B, makes it feel like they aren't overwhelmed with it? You know, it's the guy's really good. He throws really hard. Who cares about Paul Skeen's fastball shape, right? Which actually, by the way, while I've got that, The Craft is a tangential podcast. I had a theory about a month ago about Paul Skeens. I haven't looked into it. Okay. Of him having a negative IVB, that is like below average, like on the other percentile of it, and also a tendency to kind of throw low with it. Is that better for his four seamer than having higher verts and throwing low? This is a weird thought that I've had for a while, because if you guys don't remember the basis of this, when you're swinging at a low pitch, you are coming down with the bat, right? You are not necessarily fully flat. It's a very flat attack angle of the bat ultimately, but you are going from above where your chest is, where your stomach is, down toward your knees. And so having more drop on that, and when you think about being late on a pitch, right, you're still above the ball at that point. Now, if you have a lot of vert, that means if you're aiming below it and you're going down, the ball might go up into the bat, right? Which has me wondering just a little bit if there's something to be said about a certain velocity band and drop on four seamers that we might be missing. It's a weird thought.
And my initial reaction to that would be, I would assume that there's maybe some merit to it, but I almost wonder whether just him having something that's up in the zone helps everything else work.
Absolutely.
Because he's throwing
that
so much splinker now. Like that's the pitch that's down. So like if you brought the fastball down, I'd wonder whether you could just eliminate top half as a hitter and just be like, oh, I'm just going to hunt down. And like, you're still probably not going to succeed because it's Paul Skeens, but I wonder whether it's like a puzzle, you know, it's like,
right,
this piece of the puzzle could be in a different spot, but like for the whole picture to work, we need it here.
Yeah.
You know,
no,
like I might like absolutely. It better over here, but the interaction of four seam up would sink down, splinker down.
I mean, you guys falling. Know me, Blake Snell Blueprint. It's my favorite thing. If you have a hard fast, we'll just throw the thing upstairs and then throw everything off speed yeah. down.
Oh, can I counter? I don't want to counter Blake Snell Blueprint, but I think the theory I've always had on him is just that he refuses to throw four seam behind in count and he'll accept walks. Yeah. Right, like that. Well, I remember
you're not wrong in that. He needs to find his strikes and stuff, and he's like, "Cool, I'm not going to give in." I mean, he's always been a not give in.
I like that approach, though.
I'm not. It's a delicate tightrope.
It is
right
because you have to
can't
have, like,
just
stuff.
Do that, and you will get burned with it. Also, then early in council, then sit more in heaters, which then means that they'll be aggressive early and sit late and kind of, and that can be very much taken advantage of. I'm with you in that, like, yeah, Blake Snell very much has the lowest mistake rate of any major league pitcher in the past year, right? Mistake rate being double the chance of allowing a hit, throwing a pitch like it's just bad in the zone. He doesn't do it. I'm with you there. It's also because his fastball gets so much vert that, like, it's hard to have
true.
That as a mistake rate.
Yeah, he's weird slot. Like, it's weird look, weird angles, vert. It's
so
a whole...
good against the Dodgers.
Yeah.
Oh.
I mean,
the line wasn't great, but he looked so good.
The non-ramp for Montgomery and him, I think, heading into the season, you know, without spring training, like that just completely messed them up, I think. Like, I don't know what you do from a sample standpoint looking at them next year. I would just throw all that away. And like,
I mean, it's funny you want to say that, but then you want to look at 4 years of Blake Snell just like always being good after what, July 1st?
That's true.
Like,
that's true. That's a true point. Yeah, you separate both of those.
You know, that's such a strange thing. And there is a lot to be said about, having rhythm, having routine. I'm a big, big proponent of it. It's kind of why I do the roundup in the list as I do, because I think so many times you just overlook groups of data and we just say this is who they are and who they are. And my whole shtick is like, guys, Ranger Suarez was in a rhythm and he's not in a rhythm. It's not like he is good, he is bad. It's just like you have the same inherent ability or skills, but are you executing in a routine at this point? And when it gets disrupted, then all of a sudden things change. And guys do that all the time. And being able to like look at the differences of IVB or the velocity or the pitch usage, all that kind of stuff, will actually give you all the tells of that rhythm as well. So anyway, long tangent there with all of that. I appreciate how well you go on Marquee Sports and also inside of your newsletter. Just how you go about trying to explain this data in a way that is digestible from everyone else.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I think that's super important, you know. And I think it's funny, like the more you get into this stuff, the more you like start to doubt it. And I also like,
yeah,
I talk
of course.
To coaches,
oh God. Oh yes.
You know, like you doubt your own perspective, and like I think talking to coaches and talking to people in baseball has been huge for me, just like checking my biases. And even like I have the ability to go into clubhouse stuff and talk to guys too. I will admit though, I know Eno really likes talking to players. And I think this is a byproduct of the fact that he like has to actually write and quote.
Yeah.
But I like talking to coaches like so much more.
Oh, interesting.
Because most of the time with players, what I run into is like the, I'm just doing this, you know? And it's like, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. And then every now and then you run into like the Michael King where it's like, oh, I have thoughts. I will give you these thoughts. And it's like, oh,
right.
Michael, talk to me, you know?
Yeah. Oh, man.
But with the coaches, awesome. I love when I like go to a player first and ask something, and then I'll be like, that doesn't really line up with like kind of what I see in the data. But it's like, that's insane for me to say because I'm not a major.
Well, right.
Coach,
yeah.
You know? And then you go to the coach and the coach is like, oh, that guy has no idea what he's talking about. It's one of my favorite things in this sport is like,
oh,
the
man.
Coach is like, oh, he's completely clueless. Like he thinks he has two cutter shapes. I guarantee you put him in a pen, he cannot differentiate between both of them.
Right.
He can't
no,
tell
of course.
What's coming. And it's like, okay, well that helps me a little bit, I guess.
I mean, it makes a lot of sense, obviously, because these guys have been doing a certain thing for so long and they're like, I'm successful. I've been always the greatest thing in my sport forever. And thus I know what I'm talking about. I'm an expert in this. And then there's, they haven't really needed to jump into the lab and do all this stuff before in the past. Would you say that players are getting more receptive to those conversations now more than ever?
I think
like younger players
thing,
coming up through the industry. Yeah.
100,000%. The other thing I'll point out is like, I realized this because I got a chance to go to All-Star Media Day in Texas, and that's, it's kind of hilarious. Like, I don't know. I've never been to that. It's just, everyone's like lined up like cattle. And then there's like and everyone stands behind the rope. And then when the media starts, they drop the rope and everyone like runs to a player.
Oh my God.
It's one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life. And I'm just like sitting back there like, okay, like this is very awkward. And I think most of the guys I talk to there, once you like establish that you like analytics, like I'll generally just introduce myself and be like, you know, I love looking at pitch data and stuff. I want to ask you a couple questions. And most of the time, like, they'll just immediately start talking in like vert and IVB and like And it's like that has progressed a lot. Cause I think I remember when I first kind of got into this, I used to be like a stringer for the Associated Press, and I'd go into clubhouses and like, you know, my obligations for them were small. So it was like, talk to the manager, and that's kind of it. So it's like, okay, I'll go to clubhouse time and like just pick some guys' brains. And I think I ran into situations then where guys just didn't like talk vert, you know, didn't know IVB, but like, I talked to Reagan's and Scooball.
Yeah,
and
he's super. Yeah, both of them, they are super in on it. It's great.
Glass Down, so they all like, they just brought up, like, I think it was with Hauk, was like, oh, I can only get it to like 7 or 10 vert on my four seam, and I just didn't like it, so I ditched it. And it's like, I didn't say, like, do you know the vert on your four? He was like, this is the vert on my four. I couldn't get it here. And I was like, that's not just like, I love it, man. And it's become, I think it is super important for like the public to understand that stuff such that they can then understand the player and make that more commonplace in terms of the language.
And it's really, I mean, that's fantastic stuff. Speaking about like the coaches versus the players, obviously there's some that's just great. You know, obviously I've talked a lot about me just hanging out on the field with Tyone for like an hour. And it's important. It's one of the harder things I think that we do is I absolutely am conscious of players feeling like they get viewed just as money to other people, right? Like, you know, you want to talk to them. It's like, oh God, they need to talk to me for their own benefit or something. They don't really care about me, the human, anything like that. It's just like, they're trying to get something out of me. Right. And for me, I'm like, no, man, I just want to form a relationship with you. I just want to talk about this stuff. Cause this is like the most fun thing ever. I'm not trying to, you know, I'm not going to put out a video about you or something like that, or an article. I'm never going to like put out something that is negative about you, or you just like, just hang out with me, you know? Negotiating that, or really navigating that, I should say, is a really tough thing to do. And I hope that over time there, that relationship really, especially when more journalists, I think, are talking the language of the players, you know, becomes easier and easier. So that's a fun thing to kind of monitor. And, you know, I'm obviously jumping into the fray a little bit now. You talk about with like the players and the coaches. I have a situation. I've been talking to a few different coaches here and there. And like one of them, I'm trying to like say, cool, there's this one player. Like, we, you know, what about this and that? And they're like, I know, I'm with you. And it's so hard. And for all these extra reasons. And I mean, at the end of the day, the quote I can, you know, it really resonated with me. Was at the end of the day, like, these guys are trying to earn their dollar, and it's really tough to say, go and do this and make them put their money, faith in you. Right. So it's tough to do that. But man, some of the answers, I'm like, well, no, this one thing happened to this guy once after throwing it like X amount of times, and I'm never going to do it again. I'm like,
that happens a lot, man. I've run
so much. And I get it. Cause it's all about confidence and feel, but like, you know, I've thought about this a lot. I mean, I'm curious, Lance, how you stand on it. My dream job, and I know this is totally about the craft guys and everything, but I don't care. we've got a lot of interesting things to talk about too, and players and everything. But my dream job is to not really necessarily like work for a team, and be like, cool, like I am the representative of this team, and like I just work with all the players, and that's just what I do. I want like a hour consultation, once a week or whatever it is with certain players, where I just go over and chat with them about what they're doing and figure out their routines and all that kind of stuff. Just like set of eyes. That's all I want to be, because I know it's such a weird conversation. Cause like, I'm sounding so arrogant. Like, I'm just in my apartment right now and I'm saying, I know what's better for you. I am also thinking that there are certain structures that are in place that are making things too rigid for change and actually going about things all the ways that it can be done. And, you know, with all this stuff, it's just problem solving. It's like, all right, there are all these solutions. There are all these different ways of doing this kind of thing. I see so many guys just kind of stick to their guns because of X, Y, and Z. They have to do that. And you just don't. We have all of this information, and just having those conversations, I just don't think they happen enough.
I agree. I think you're spot on. It's almost like the idea that I almost prefer looking at the guy who has like the 5.5 ERA through 50 innings than the guy who's like a 4.4 with mediocre stuff. Cause the 5.5 guy's probably like, I need you something right now. Like I can't, even if you're telling me my X ERA.
Oh, that's a really good,
it does not matter to me at all. Like I need to be better right now. And this is like the Hunter Brown early in the season, right? Mm. Like he had like a 6.5 in April.
Well, it was, that 9-run game against the Royals where he just couldn't do anything.
And like the underlying stuff said, like he's probably more like a mid-4s, and like didn't matter. That dude changed everything, right? Moved on the rubber, ditched the four seam, added a sinker, threw away the cutter they learned in the offseason. Like there's very few situations where I saw like that whole scale of a change, you know?
And well, like, I mean, he's still changing is the problem. He's a laboratory,
but.
You know,
but I find that so funny. Like, I love the guys who were like I was looking at like Luis L. Ortiz the other day from the Pirates, and like,
oh yeah, Cutter, man,
last year he was terrible.
Cutter,
lower arm, like the force somehow playing up a little more, even though it looks a little bit worse to me. Like, it's just he changed like 5 things, and it's like I just love those guys.
Oh yeah, that's why I mean, look, the perfect one actually to me is Patrick Corbin right now. Did you notice his last start?
Hold on, he lands in like the Chris Flexen area where I don't think he's fixable. I'm sorry.
I just don't think he's fixable. Chris Flexen has had a surprising number of good performances this year because if he has his command working with like 4 pitches, which he's done, he's flexing at the beach, not flexing in the mirror. I understand with you, and like I'm going to give Flexen the benefit of the doubt of like everyone's a major leaguer for a reason.
That's
right.
That's
every single guy has enough of an ability to then produce on a given day. I'm not saying that Flexen always will. He'll be the first, I'm sure, to say that, but that's fine. He's actually become productive for his team multiple times this year. And it's there. With Corbin, it's so funny because there are times when he's just like, I got nothing today. I'm just going to do the sinker slide or whatever, call it a day. 5 runs, fine. Goodbye. But then it's like, oh, you know what? I'm going to throw 50% cutters now. And treated it like his slider, but it's a harder one with a little bit less aggressive movement. And I think that's good because my whole theory with Corbin has been, you just telegraph your slider every time now. I feel like that's just what's going on. I feel like every time I was watching it subconsciously, I could just tell that it was a slider. I couldn't really slow it down and tell you what it was. But as someone who looks at the glove when delivery is happening, not the ball, I can just see out of the corner of my eye, like, oh no, this is the cocked arm with the slider as opposed to just a smoother delivery with the fastball. And like, you gotta, even though that's a big whiff pitch and everything like that, it's just, I don't know. I just, you should be experimenting if you're Patrick Corbin, right? And that's the whole Hunter Brown thing is like, you're not doing well. You got to figure it out. Patrick Corbin's isn't even the most ideal situation of like, I've got my contract. I'm whatever. I'm going to start. So why not? I want to see a 20% fastball game from Corbin. I want to see cutters and sliders and like rare sinkers inside to lefties and maybe an occasional fastball to righties, but really just cutters inside and then sliders underneath. I want to see him go like the Mitch Spence.
Those guys will just change everything. Like, you're just not doing well. Like, I just think teams are afraid of like accepting like some downside risk on the guy. You know, I mean, Corbin doesn't apply to, but let's say the guy's like a 4-5 and he's done it for 150 innings. And it's like, okay, like it's not great. You know, we probably have better options. You know, we got to figure out maybe what this young guy is at AAA, but.
Sure.
In that player, as an organization, I think you just need to accept more risk and change things to make him better and see if he is better. You know, like it's a range of outcomes. Maybe he turns into a 5-year Ega and you dip him up and it's not great. But like there's also a chance he turns into like a 3-8 and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, okay. Like this is a much better pitcher. You know, if he's close to end of contract, we can flip him. I just think organizations are super risk averse. And I've heard this from a variety of analysts, et cetera. And I imagine you've heard this from coaches as well. It's just,
it's just
things that are obvious just don't happen. And
what's so crazy to me is that there are all these organizations that are risk averse, but they've got nothing to lose.
Exactly. That's the frustrating point, I think, a lot of the time, right?
It's like, I don't know. There's only like 30 organizations. So like,
I know.
It's a case of, if there were more of them, you'd find fewer of these examples, I think, because they'd be more obvious and they stick out more. And when you only have so many positions and also people ingrained in those positions without a reason to change outside of winning, but winning, what is the point of winning? Right? Who cares? It's a business.
54%, baby. Come on.
Yeah. Oh my God. Anyway.
I have a hot take on this. So like, I think DePoto should have just said, we're trying to win like 92 plus a year. Cause that's just around the 54%. He was
right. I mean, that's it.
54% just sounds terrible.
It really
does.
Man. It's kind of funny. How do you feel about the stance of if the playoffs were, my whole thing is, I think every team that finishes above 500, so better than a 50% winning percentage, should make the playoffs every year. How do you feel about that?
That's an interesting thought that I have not thought of. What's like,
okay, so the incentives right of it are multiple things. One, I love the one game playoff. I think it's so great. It's fun. I think it's like the best moment in baseball. Your game sevens, you're making them. You have more of them. You essentially make it so that it's really ultimately a six team playoff. So 3 plays 6, 4 plays 5, and then a bye with the 1 and 2. And then to determine the last spots, you have 5 play 8, 6 play 7, and a 1-game playoff. If there are 9, 8 plays 9, and then you do the same thing again, so on and so forth. You can even expand it out a little bit more if you need to with more teams. It's very unlikely, but that would be the situation. It's easy to do that. You have that ingrained in the schedule for the playoffs already. You can make that time. It's not something that's impossible to do. Absolutely easy to do.
Never thought of this.
And what you can do then, A, regular season matters more because now you have 2 byes, and also you don't want to be the 3 seed. You don't want to be that, right? And you make it 2 divisions, essentially. You can do that. You can make it one, top of one division, one the other, if you want. But I see it just as regular season matters more than ever because of where you are seated. You don't want the 1-game playoff, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It makes it so other teams doing a certain way matter more for your teams than just inside of your division or just the wild card. So it's like, no, there's a whole like large amount of it. Trade deadline becomes so interesting.
Yeah.
Of like who's in, who's out. The guys that are actually selling are going to be getting much more back, which I think is a good thing. You want to make it so that there's a lot more of exciting, big blockbuster trades as opposed to just kind of middling things because the guy's contract is going up and no one cares about this or whatever. You don't make it so it's just only like certain teams always getting a certain guy. I just think it's just the best. And you make it so that you want to make it so that more fans are watching baseball in September. You want to make it so that there's more excitement for your team. It's not just July and you're already out of it because, oh, look, the Phillies are going to win the division and like we don't really have that great of a team. But if you're like 3 games behind 500 right now, you're like, we're almost there. You know,
it's an interesting thought. Longer. I'm trying to think of like what the negative side effects of this would be because I feel like
everyone makes the playoffs then, and you know, then like who cares about the regular season kind of thing. I'm like, dude, you got to go through a gauntlet to get there.
It's true.
You know? Right?
I don't mind it.
Yeah.
It's a fun idea.
Make me commissioner, Lance.
I would be a terrible commissioner.
Just make me commissioner.
I can do that. I
don't want to be commissioner at all. Jesus.
That's a terrible job.
But all right. We're actually going to talk about actual pitchers and, of course, stats that we are, that have just been kind of messing around in our head. We're going to be doing all of that, of course, after this break. So, Lance, you sent me a list of pitchers that you wanted to talk about. And I want to tell you guys right now, there's no way we're going to do Kate Smith because that's a reliever. How dare you? So,
I actually made a great point in it, though, that I think it's
awesome. Okay, what do you got about Kate Smith? I'm not going to chime in. I'm just going to nod my head.
It's shameless plug. So, I'm doing a little video on him, but he's a fascinating pitcher. He's like one of the best relievers in baseball this year. And I don't think anyone knows who the heck he is. Two things. One, the Guardians are really good at pitching development. This guy sat 88 in Hawaii. Okay, when he was at Hawaii, he's gained.
Okay,
six
hold on.
I just want to
clarify something really quickly.
Yeah.
You say pitching development, but in the minors, not when they're in the majors.
I think they're good all around. I think they're good. Okay. Do you not like them from a major league side?
I don't know in the majors if they are. Okay. I get a sense that pretty much they do a really good job prepping guys for the majors, but once they arrive here, they're not very good.
That's fair. I think I see that with a lot of organizations. You know,
sure.
I think the one thing you'll run into a lot is seeing major league staffs that are better than minor league staffs or the vice versa, where you have like older voices stuck at the major league level that don't push things properly. You know what I mean? So maybe there's an element of that. I would say in totality, though, I think they do a really good job at least developing velocity, developing major league type arms.
Yeah. So he was, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Maybe not.
88 in Hawaii. Yep.
So 88 in Hawaii, he's gained like 6 ticks as he's gone through the Guardians organization, had a small velo jump. He's a 2020 guy from that weird draft. So he's a UDFA. Yep. He's an interesting guy for one reason. The thing I want to point out here is it's huge extension. It's like 7.4 feet. So he's up in like the 99th percentile or so. Just like 1% of pitchers, at least the ball closer to the plate than him. But I think one of the reasons that extension is so important, I imagine you've mentioned this before. If I haven't heard it, then apologies. I'm probably just
reiterating. Oh, go ahead.
I think that a lot of the time what we miss with release side and extension, I consider those like the two, I call them like biomech variables. So those are the only things we have from an understanding standpoint of how the body's moving in space.
Yeah.
And the problem with them is that they're both like towards the end of delivery. They're both at ball release. We're measuring there. Sure. We're not measuring anything prior. So when you track those like over a course of time and stuff, most of the time when those are changing, it's probably a byproduct of something happening earlier in your kinetic chain.
Correct.
You know?
Right.
You know, lead leg block changes, something changes, he's dipping more, et cetera. And then the ball comes out lower or his arm slot drops, et cetera. Could just be fatigue. Maybe over time, slot drops because of that. Maybe he's hiking it too much, shoulder problems, et cetera. With Cade Smith, he's 6'5". He gets to an average release. And I think a lot of the time I'm not sure how many models have built-in pitcher height into release and extension
We certainly do, yes.
I think that's super important. And I don't even know if it's something that would be caught large scale on the data side. I think a lot of times we might run into stuff in stuff models where it's like, well, we integrated pitch height, but or pitcher height, excuse me, the literal height of
right,
the human.
Right, yes.
We integrated this and it didn't really do anything, so we just left it out of the model. But I think the sharper orgs and people who like understand this stuff models really well can like look at a stuff model and then go, oh, it's missing this, you know? Like sure. Kate Smith has big extension, which gets his release to average, but he's not an average release. Like there's no way that release point looks average to a hitter. Mm. And I think that this unveils like the whole idea of visual for a pitcher, what the visual they create, whether it be from body or from pitch type.
Oh, that's it. Yeah, that's very interesting.
A point of pitching that is just missed. And I don't know if we'll ever be able to measure on the public side, but I imagine.
I think we can. I have actually a good proposition for you.
Oh, anyway, I'll finish the thought on Kate. Yeah, yeah. I'll finish the thought on Kate. So big extension release. The other thing here is he's a reliever who has the highest four-seam zone rate in baseball, minimum 250 four-seam fastballs thrown. 66%. Right? He's the highest. And then this leads me to my last point. How is he not a starting pitcher? Because he has a split, which I know you hate, and then he has a sweeper.
Whoa,
he's got three pitches.
Whoa. Everyone forgets the nuance of why I don't like splitters. It's splitters as your primary strike pitch among your secondaries. The primary secondary strike pitch.
That's fair.
That's one I don't like splitters because they're the most inconsistent one. And you're not going to get consistent strikes usually with a splitter because it's very much of a different feel than it is a traditional breaking ball or a changeup. So that's the big.
Hate him.
I don't. I love them as your third whiff pitch. Like Kodai Senga's, I love because he has a cutter, right? That's a big difference. Now, when I heard Hunter Green learning a splitter, I'm like, why? You don't need that. You need another strike pitch. Like you just set up the slider and the four seamer more, not to get
Hunter
that
Green was on the list of guys to talk about because he
right.
Me. So like, let's stick on.
Oh yeah, he increased his vert this year. It's really nice to see better command. I think overall the slider doesn't get enough whiffs. It's kind of strange, but whatever,
I would argue
fine.
Nothing changed with him. So well, maybe that's
interesting.
For 10 minutes down. Oh,
that's so.
I don't.
That sounds interesting too. Yeah. Right. But with Kate Smith, what you get me thinking about is, so I just want to get this clear. I'm thinking of like a guy that is a dip and dive, right?
Sure.
Or dip and drive. Funny. And then like a really tall guy, right? So how the arm, the angle of the arm from the rubber to release point is what I think you're looking for, right? Because what you're suggesting is the look of the ball movement between the mound and release point. If it's a consistent line, it makes it easier for the batter to read it as to where it's going to be coming out and going. However, if it's really tall and you're doing kind of a loop down, like a as if you're going down a skateboard ramp to get to the spot, that's going to be a lot more deceptive as to where actually this ball is going to, the trajectory of it out of the hand. Is that what you're framing a bit when it comes to deception of the height at the release point?
I think maybe even my interpretation of it is just simpler. It's just like there are certain guys who are really tall who throw with arm angles that get them to more average releases that do not make anything look average about them. And the other two names that come to mind are like Yuri Perez and Paul Skenes, right? Like both those guys, I think line up.
Yeah, that's insane that Yuri Perez has it. Yeah,
right. It's, and it's like, I mean, so that point in space relative to other arms doesn't really change, you know. So based on that variable, you'd think that if I'm looking at a Paul Skenes or a Yuri, and I'm like, this is the release point. It's actually the same release point you saw from this other guy who's 4 inches shorter and has a higher trunk tilt, and he's tilting up and he's getting to some, you know, higher release, whatever, you know? And I think this is the point of this that I think matters is like we've gone towards like low slot vert so much that I wonder whether there's value to be captured on like just big dudes who are able to get to weird release points or average release points in weird ways.
Yeah, the dip and drive tall boys.
Yeah, that's maybe the way to put it, right? Like,
yeah,
I think it's there's something there visually that really impacts hitters beyond whatever stuff is going to be able to capture.
I've thought about this a lot. I've been talking to Kyle about it, about like the relationship between extension and not even vert, just extension and HAVA, all right, height adjusted VAA, and saying, is there like, let's just put it this way. It's not as simple as like you have a 10 and 1 and 5 of 1 that makes 15, but you have a 5 and 1, 10 and 1 that makes 15. That's not how it works. It's not like the same equated value of like this HAVA at this extension is the same as this extension of this hobbit, right? So there's a thought that I'm having here about, like, if you get a ton of extension, is that how impactful is it on the if you have a certain hobbit attached to it, right? And it's actually part of a larger project that I'm working on with Kyle, which takes a lot of effort. There's 20 million things on his plate, of course. But just saying, of what I call the fan four, the fantastic four, the four elements of a four seamer that have the biggest influence on whether it's going to be a whiff or not, that is velocity, extension, IVB, and height adjusted VAA. How each of those impacts the others, and what, you know, if I just look at two of them, what is the relationship between them, both of them, and so on and so forth. Just to get a quick glance of, like, well, all right, if he increases his X, but he doesn't increase this, it actually doesn't have that large of an impact, but this one does over this time, and so on and so forth. So that might be it of, like, the ones that you're talking about, if they're getting to that release point, because they're really tall and they get to it, that means that they have to be dipping. They have to be,
dipping, doing, by the way, if you guys don't know that. Body-wise.
They have to be lowering their back leg and bending that knee a ton before falling forward. There's really two theories of pitching, in my view. I mean, there's many, but, you know, like, of how to approach home plate. One is stays tall and lean with the front fold shoulder forward and essentially guide everything in one, you know, like a 45 degree angle down. Mm-hmm. And the other is go up and then bend straight down, make a right angle, right, on that side of the triangle to get to the same point, right? And the dip and drives are the ones that generally have better height adjusted VAA. And if you look at the Japanese pitchers of Imanaga and Kikuchi and Darvish, why do they have such good flat attack angles? Because they all do that. They all dip and drive. And that's how they're able to still stay on top of the ball and get good verts while having these better attack angles, right? So it's something I've certainly thought a lot about.
Yeah.
Man, dipping and driving is good. You know, that's what David Cohen used to do. Fortunately, I was of that camp for a bit because I literally modeled after David Cohen as a kid. And then I got changed in college and I still think about that all the time. that might be if there's a way for us to see how much you're dipping, like, in your mechanics, and seeing if there's something to that, because we get more limb tracking data. We might.
I wonder whether that stuff will ever be public. But no, I do agree. Yeah. I have to say, like, my biomech brain is not particularly strong. I just don't. You know, I definitely learn more through objective data and, like, also talking to people.
Yeah.
And most of the time, I'm starting to dip my toe into that. But you definitely have a better understanding than me.
I mean, I'm just I'm the snake oil guy. Anytime you talk about mechanics, I just call it snake oil, because there's anyone that tells you this is the only way to do it, it's like,
yeah, exactly.
Because and everyone's got different opinions about this. Like, this is bad. It's like, oh gosh. So and then there's a whole thing about sequencing. I have I don't know if I sent it to you. I will. I wrote it last year. I probably want to reformat it. It's a secret document, guys. It is Nick Pollock's Secrets of Sequencing. And
mechanically, you're talking like body segments or just
some of it. This is the other part of snake oil. So snake oil being mechanics, and also it's like, oh no, I know how to sequence or something like that. It's like, you're never really going to have an objective truth because you're dealing with another human, and those humans are not going to always be the same in how they pick it up. But it has a whole outline of, like, reading other people's body languages, what are they expecting? How do we generalize this and that? Where should you put it and stuff? And I'm actually really curious about your two cents on this.
Okay.
Your way, if you haven't seen it. It's a very secret document, guys. Okay. Maybe I'll give it out to PL Pro people in the future. And I don't think that there's a benefit of putting it public, because everyone will just yell at me and they won't have good discourse with it. So anyway, I'm going to move on because I'm rambling. Kate Smith, super interesting. I think that is something to look into. Everybody listening right now, always, I appreciate you guys tweeting at us and saying, hey, look, yeah, look into that kind of thing. This is that. So many fun things have been uncovered through these conversations. I can't believe you put Cole Reagans here.
Yeah, I talked to him at the media day, so I had it.
There you go. So what do you got? Yeah.
So I think the thing here that I thought was interesting was early season, Cutter was pretty bad, right? He was missing arm side with it a lot.
Yeah,
it shows up in absolutely. Emails, right? My first thought on that was, why? Like, yeah, obviously you look at anything and you go, okay, that's bad. Why? You know, like, and not why, like, you can point out the locations now, arm side's getting crushed, but more so, like, why is it occurring? And the only thing I could find in that window that changed was he moved on the rubber.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, I know Chamberlain had a good piece a while back on HAA, and he always kind of played around with the idea that, like, oh, one way to just back in two different locations without much change in mechanics or shape is to just, like, move on the rubber, and maybe that affects locations. I wondered whether him moving to the center of the rubber created issues with the cutter going arm side. So sure. He then moved back to where he was on the rubber, basically comparable to last year. I think it's a little bit, couple inches off. Mm-hmm. And I asked him at media day, like, what he did, and like just explain this trajectory, because the cutter usage went like 25-ish% to righties, blah blah blah, and then it dipped, and then it's come back up, and it's been pretty good since, and he's got it back up and inside. He said he's played with a couple different grips.
Yep.
And I thought that was kind of interesting, especially combined with the rubber move, from the perspective of understanding the relationship between pitch location and pitch shape, like the idea that they're both, I think, somewhat interconnected.
Yeah.
More vert is generally going to be higher in the zone. So like controlling forward location causes these things, but the cutter shape for him, I don't believe changed a ton. So it's one of those things where I like the idea of it now being up and in how it was in 2023. But I thought it was pretty interesting that like grip got him to a different location, but didn't actually change the shape of the pitch.
Yeah.
So I mean, he's that's kind of weird.
Well, I mean, also when it comes to location, I know that Reagan's has been trying to backdoor a bit more. Which I think is actually a really good idea, because I think especially against right-handers, if they're keyed off of the changeup, which can happen, especially, I mean, sometimes with them, they'll go fastball hunting, and the cutter can be a really good, especially if it's something that starts off the plate away, that's completely just, you know, turned off. That's not gonna be the four seamer first strike, it's not the changeup first strike. So to have the cutter actually be like a potential one that gets them now swinging more on those changeups and fastballs is actually pretty cool backdoor. But yeah, I'm with you. I've texted him and be like, dude, I just want to see one of those cutters inside again. Like that's the,
yeah.
That is the thing that I think, it's been very strange. I mean, there's obviously the velocity drop recently that was just kind of weird. I've talked to him a little bit.
I saw that. Yeah.
There is, I think it's a little bit of fatigue at this point, which isn't surprising because it's his first real full year.
Yeah.
But I, you know, it's bound to happen at some point every single year. I think if you do this right at this point, you can get back and be like, okay, let's just take it a little easy for like one or two starts, and then you should be okay. Maybe adjust the bullpens in between or something along those lines. But mainly, if that cutter is doing what it used to do last year up and in, I mean that's the best version of Cole Reagan's. It's not even close. And the four seamer has been like the one that gets him in trouble a lot. Even though it's a really amazing overpowering pitch, he just doesn't have that. I need a strike pitch outside of the changeup, and usually a slider and cutter are the ones that you can really rely on those. So getting back to that cutter being amazing, I think that makes Cole Reagan's absurdly good once again. I don't think the curveball is consistent enough, which is unfortunate.
The last thing I'll mention on the Reagan's cutter too is like, I think in looking at him, I started to like think more about how usage and count affects like some batted ball results. Batted ball results are often
absolutely
really frustrating to look at on like a start-to-start basis, because like I'm not like that stuff doesn't stabilize quick. I understand that.
No.
You know, you're not couldn't spray, like you really gotta look at individual spots. You get four balls in play, one's a barrel, and it's like, oh, he just missed his spot. It's like, well, is that indicative of anything to come, or like did he just miss his spot, etc.? But like I think because the utility of that cutter for him is primarily like behind in count to get back into counts, whether it be like 2-0, 2-1, 1-0, you know, like you're going to have like a naturally inflated, say, X-Wave on contact or anything along those lines. So you guys like use like ICR on that stuff.
Yeah, ICR is fun. I'm trying to make it so that ICR gets rid of flares, but I'm going to. Yeah,
but like that stuff, like cal leverage is super important. I think sometimes like I just look at, if you look at him, there you go. If you look at him in the sense of like last 2 years, what has he done? And you look at individual pitch level results, you might be like, oh, the cutter's not that good. And it's like, no, that cutter's really good because everyone sucks behind an account, and he's able to throw this pitch like 30% of the time when it's on behind a count and get like league average slug, you know? And,
oh
like,
man, that, you just got my brain cooking for multiple things.
I think is super important. Like, I don't know if there's, I haven't thought about it a lot. This is like more of a fresh idea, but the concept of like, what do you have behind an account that can make you a league average pitcher? Because everyone is well worse than league average
behind
the count.
Yeah, you know? So a couple things. One, Lance was reacting to my shirt, which is the pitcherless stats shirt. Think of the classic WOBA shirt. We made one for pitcherless that has ICR on it. But a couple things. One, I'm very much against utilizing result-based outcomes, like contact-based outcomes.
I know.
By a pitch. And I know you agree with me on that. You mentioned slug and stuff. And I understand slug because it's just showcasing like how they hit it.
Yeah.
And also, it's often weird samples. What was that one? Who was hitting it? What was set up for it? What was the count? All this kind of stuff just goes kind of out the window when you look at that. It's like, well, no, I allowed a home run or two on this one, so it's bad. I'm like, no, it's not. It's just that one outcome did that. It's very rare to see a proper sample that really showcases that. It's why I kind of like ICR more, because that is just generalized all contact as opposed to the singular one result of it. It's just saying, what kind of quality is it, as opposed to just saying, well, that one happened to go out and this one didn't, that kind of thing. But what you really, and by the way, ICR is not perfect in this. This is why strike minus ICR is kind of the cooler one. Striker, we got to do more with it. Anyway, the thing you got me really thinking about there, though, man, is, okay, analyzing, I call it three different ones. It's early, behind, and late. And late is really just two strikes. And behind is essentially 2-0, 2-1, 3-0, 3-1. And then everything else is early. So it's 0-0, 1-0, 1-1, 0-1. Okay. And among those, saying, okay, how much better is this on the results of anything that came into play at this point, and not including strikeouts, anything in play at this point, is that better or worse than average? Mm. Right? That is actually a way to kind of assess that, being like, generally, I mean, I know that there are more different ranges of, hey, you're at 2-0 versus like 3-1 or something like that, or fine. But I think for the most part, those are buckets of like generalized outcomes for pitchers, of just like, you are below average in these, you're above average in two strikes, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're able to say, okay, when you throw this cutter, because you always throw this behind in counts, you're actually performing better than any other pitches that have created balls in play on these counts, right? Maybe that's an interesting way to phrase it, of success of certain pitches about certain, maybe we just do every single count when you throw these. The other one is, how many times you throw non-competitive pitches before a certain pitch? Like saying, all right, yeah, they just hit the fastball because he just threw two changeups that were really bad, and he's not going to swing at a changeup now, so he's going to throw the fastball, and he's going to key on the fastball, and bam, there you go, you got a hit. And that's not the fastball's fault. It's the changeup's fault. And I talk about it all the time, of like, oh, like, he just needs one other thing so that guys can't key in on this thing. Bryce Miller, please. Oh, please get me a secondary that works, like, so often, you know. And that means that the four seamer, which we already grade is really good, will be even better, because you have to deal with that, right? It's why Kodai Senga's four seamer does as well as it does, because the cutter is so good to nullify inside the zone. It's why the forkball is as good as it is, because of that cutter and four seamer. And the way that we can assess that, maybe, because it's really hard to do that, is quantifying how many wastes are inside the at bat before that pitch is thrown. I don't know. I'm just trying to figure out something. You got my mind going.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting thought too. Yeah, I just think the intent, I mean, this is very obvious observation, but the intent changes a lot. Like, I think a lot of the times on the public side, we get like really focused on like what pitchers control, like whiff, et cetera. And I totally understand that, because that, if you're predicting, like, that's probably the best way to go. But on like an individual game basis and looking at batter versus pitcher interactions, like, and my intent, if I get behind 2-1, is not to generate a swing and miss. I do not care. Like, I'm probably trying to get something.
You want a cutter inside, sinker inside.
Exactly.
Like,
I want weak contact or something to get out of that AB. Because Pablo Lopez has added
so nice since last year. He started to do that. And it's just like, yes, I love it so much. He does it.
What happened to his forcing location, though, early this season? Wasn't that?
I know. I think honestly, that's a product of his changeup being really weird. Because he's not executing the changeup as much as he wants. Also, the sweeper was really bad early on. He just felt like he had to just get the single. He couldn't nibble as much. You know, intent changed, I think. But now it's getting better. So
yeah,
we'll see.
Yeah.
Change, just take it down a little bit more.
Yeah.
Oh, it's good stuff. Okay. We have more to talk about. You have also, a guy who debuted on Monday, which I'm very curious to hear your thoughts on. And you have some half-baked ideas, which I'm sure are more than half-baked, that you have listed out here. We're going to get to all of that after this break. All right, we're back. So River Ryan made his MLB debut on Monday night. I want to hear your thoughts directly about this new guy for the Dodgers. Obviously, it's feels like every year it's just like, well, okay, the Dodgers have someone with ridiculous stuff, and I guess this is great. How do you feel about him?
I'm a big fan. I really like him. I think he's one of, like, probably top five-ish pitching prospect in all of baseball. It's a really polished mix. It's six pitches. They're all pretty much average or better, I think, in stuff models, depending on which one you look at. there's a couple pieces here that I really like. I really like the curveball on him. I think a lot of the time, like, you look at curveballs as like strike stealers early count, which has utility because guys just very rarely swing at those kinds of pitches. So, like, sure, why not? If you can command that pitch and zone it above 50%, like, give me it early. But his is like really hard, and it has, you know, sweep and negative vert that lines up with pitches that are like three ticks slower. He's sitting like, I this season I'm combining like AAA data along with the major league debut. He's like 83.5 velo on the curveball at like negative 11 vert and negative 11 sweep. Like, that's like, that's a deep count pitch as well as early count for me. I love that. I think that's kind of like a hack for him. I also think just the mix as a whole is pretty fleshed out. Like, to me, there's not much else to do in terms of shape here. Like, I already saw people like, oh, you should go to sweeper, you should go to sweeper. It's like, the Dodgers hate sweepers.
Why are you asking him to get more stuff? He has so much stuff.
I don't want a sweeper. The Dodgers also just never do that. I'm pretty sure they hate sweepers on starters, just as a general philosophy.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, that's actually a really good point. They're not a sweeping team.
Very few. A lot of relievers, but if you look at like them and early, just like innings 1 through 5 sweeper uses, I'm pretty sure they're bottom five baseball if you sort that out.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me at all. I'm just saying, they're guys like, who even throws a sweeper?
Now, I know you hate that they don't elevate four seam a lot.
I do.
Especially early count. But River Ryan is literally the guy you're going to hate because of that. If you split him based on count, he's fastball away to righties early, and he's fastball up to righties.
This is the Dodgers' way.
This is the Dodgers' way. Now, why could this be the Dodgers' way? Something that I've asked around, especially some Dodger people as well. The one thing I found interesting is that they don't necessarily do this a ton on the minor league side, from my understanding. Hmm. If you look at, like, below, say, AAA and such, some of the coaches I've talked to there are just like, no, we don't really preach, like, four away and four up. It's kind of something that as they ascend, it seems to be picked up and pushed. So maybe that's a byproduct of like what they're trying to do in the minors versus what they're trying to do in the majors. Now, I think I like this concept. And this is one of my half-baked ideas, so we're going to bring this into River Ryan. But it's the idea that I actually think there's something to forcing fastballs away early count that establishes this concept that I've heard and I kind of like as like pitching off lines, so to speak. And this gets into the idea of like, use your misses properly. I was talking to like Scoobal about this too, where he's like, I think of where I'm going to miss on a pitch and then where I actually miss on the pitch and then how I could utilize that miss. Pretty basic stuff that you've heard probably a lot of people talk about.
Yeah, no, making sure the mistakes help me in the
exactly. Like, what am I doing relative to that mistake? Can it help me? If I miss arm side away to a lefty with a four seam, like, can I use that as a backdoor for my slider? Am I confident doing that? Am I going to miss that over the play? Like, these thoughts generally.
Yeah.
I think the idea of throwing four seam away early is primarily based on count leverage. I haven't actually seen data on this, but I wonder whether, and again, you're getting to some intended target stuff here, which I know some companies have, but there isn't really a public thing.
No, it's also what is intent, because where the glove is not necessarily where they want to throw it. It drives
me up. DriveLine uses a lot of this information in some of their command models and stuff, but like, they also admit a lot of the time that they just like, we don't know intent. We're guessing, and we're hoping that in large samples, we're smoothing it out, some of the errors, so to speak.
Right.
But I think I like the forcing away from A, count leverage. B, I think what it does, and I don't know if this is lined up in tunneling, but there's something about establishing hard out or third that I'm guessing the Dodgers think helps anything breaking glove side off plate. Such that if you do that early, you're giving me A, better count leverage, and then B, ability to set up and use a variety of pitches as I get into like 1-1 situations or deep count, where I can go cutter off plate, I could go curveball off plate, I could go slider off plate. I could also then elevate the four. Like, there's options there. Whereas I think we see a lot of pitchers come up and are like four vert up and then slider down. Like, David Festa is one of the ones that came up in my mind, just I'm thinking of it right now.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, right.
He's vert up, slider down, and it's like, it looked great, and it just didn't work in the majors. And it's like, I wonder whether he's a guy that's like, let me throw this away. We saw with Tobias Myers, too, where he early in the season got hammered throwing four seams up, slider down. They then went, your four seam location out of righty is away. We will elevate late, and everything opened up for him off that. So I'm not saying it's like a foolproof way to approach pitching, but
no.
I think about four seam in not optimal locations as a way of helping the rest of repertoire.
I think you're absolutely onto something, 100%. A couple things. One, James and Tyone talked about this very thing of like when he was with the Yankees, he was going four seamer up and we get like a whiff and stuff, foul ball or whatever. Great. But then like, I don't have that 0-2. I can't get past him at that point. And Ben Brown, he was in the context of him saying like, well, he's got to learn like that can't just be what you do. You got to have something else in there too. So I completely hear you on this. And also I think the main thing, my whole idea is, away with a four seamer early, especially if it's down, as opposed to middle away four seamers. I can't get behind in any situation. I'm so sorry. You literally just saw Quintana throw a fastball away to Gleyber Torres yesterday and just poked it to right field for a home run? It's like, yeah, because that's the easiest fastball to hit. I can't express that enough. It's easier than middle-middle, believe it or not, because you get more time. You get more time away than you do middle-middle, right? And it's so many guys are able to just take advantage of that pitch these days, middle away, especially if they ever want to swing. That said, down away, if you can hit that down away fastball, you will get a called strike all day. You will get that. And as you're mentioning, 100%, you've set up everything else that isn't the high fastball now. So it's absolutely right of, yeah, that your slider can play off of that. Your changeup can play off of that. Now also actually does set up the high fastball because they're not looking for that. If you can hit that and showcase that you're doing it, absolutely, I'm here for it. So this is not a half-baked idea whatsoever. I think you're completely right. The problem I have is, one, it is so hard to hit that.
That's a fair point.
Really, really hard to hit that. And what I see often is either it screams off middle down, and that's very, if the guy's up to the plate and wants to hammer you, oh my gosh, that is a good pitch because the bat speed is faster down and it's closer to you. And they're like thinking middle, and it's just a little bit lower. Like, sure, I can just adjust this. Bam, done, right? That's going to get hit. Two, if it goes too high up, if it goes middle, that's also good. And a lot of these guys, especially the younger ones, they don't have that skill. Bobby Miller might, maybe, ish. He doesn't, I've never really had amazing command. Bueller, I think, could. Yamamoto frustrates me because it has to be a balance. I need to understand that you are also getting like at 1-1, 1-2 or whatever it is, 1-2, like you can go upstairs and you will take advantage of it, right? Instead of trying to get it in 2-1, okay, now I'm just going to throw a lower fastball. Like, no, they're going to be there now. They're going to be ready for that one, more ready to swing than they are in 0-0 to take advantage of it, right? So it's about the journey of the at-bat and recognizing, I think the Dodgers are saying, look, you get more called strikes away on it, and also there's lower slugging down away, right? And I get that, but also you got to look at the individuals throwing them and what is their skill set? What is actually the thing? And they're not doing it. And it's even more so, I think, with River Ryan, and this is actually my real thought of this, is like, the Dodgers are leaning into being stuffists completely. Of just look at Bobby Miller and Bueller and River Ryan and like Landon Knack even. Of like, all right, you guys just have these things. Sweet. We got you with your slider. We got you with your curveball and your fastball and whatever. And like, okay, what do we do with it? I don't know. Like, it's like they don't put it. They don't have a thing that, like, I watch these games and I also am like, what was it? I'm trying to make it out. And I look at the strike zone plan, I'm like, this is making it worse. Now I'm even more confused. And I feel like every single pitch is kind of like a random number generator. Except definitely not high fastball. but right. It's like that element is missing of just, hey, look at what you do and then say, cool, this is how we're going to make sure you continuously focus on this. And the idea of teams scouting you and be like, no, I know what you're going to throw me. Doesn't matter. Go lean into what you're good at and then make small tweaks to keep them off of that and make them doubt that game plan. That's the way to do it. Not be like, I'm just going to throw a slider now. I'm going to throw a changeup now. I'm just going to, oh, I guess the sinker or whatever. Like, no, you got to have more of a dignified approach.
my Galaxy brand idea there is that they're so convinced they're going to make the playoffs that a lot of their in-season stuff is just like creating noise for teams from an advanced standpoint.
Oh my gosh.
But I don't know if that's true. That's like my Galaxy brand. That's a truly half-baked idea where they just don't really care about the regular season. And they're just like, yeah, we'll random number generate throughout the year such that when you then look back at what this guy does, you have literally no idea what he's doing. You know?
Oh, man.
Like, why not?
Yeah.
I think that if you're so confident the Dodgers would make the postseason, you could pick up James Paxton and DFA him halfway through the year. You know, turn it
that was the funniest thing ever. But I think about Maddux. Maddux threw an inside fastball to Jeff Bagwell and allowed a home run to him. And then Lopez is like, why'd you throw that? Because we're going to face him in the playoffs. He's going to be thinking about that the entire time.
There's teams that I think about that stuff more than we think. You know? Like, there's certain teams. Like, the Phillies got to be thinking about that stuff already. You know, like, they're in it. Mm. They need to win in the postseason. You know? Like, I don't think they're really
what relievers are they showing them now? On. That kind of thing, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. That's interesting. Oh, boy. This game, Lance. All right. So... any last thoughts on River Ryan? Do you think like they're his stuff is amazing.
He looks great. No, I just think it's multiple really good pitches. And I just think like Dodgers are good at developing mixes. He has, I think, some semblance of reasonable command just from my eye and seeing some minor league outings and stuff. Like, he's maybe average-ish. Maybe he'll pick up a little bit better over time. It looks good. Like, there's a single.
He's called a Dodger in a week.
I'll go yes.
Yeah.
I think they like him from like a future.
This guy's but also it's like, hey, we can get Tarek Skubal now. We're just gonna.
I know.
We got to showcase trade and package him in there.
I feel like that's such a bluff to me. You think they should? I don't think they should.
I mean, they'll get such a package.
Yeah, but like, I'm getting tired of like these teams with 2 years of control on a guy. Like, no, we're not gonna be competitive in 2 years, and it's like, my God, like, you guys don't think you're gonna be competitive in 2 years with that? Like, they got Job. That team's not terrible. Like, I think they have some sharp people there on the pitching side. They've done a good job with Flaherty. Robin Lund's a sharp guy. Like, Fetter. Like, I don't.
I'm
not convinced that team can't put up like an 88 to 91 season in the next 2 seasons.
I know. Like, but it's. I guess what I'm getting at is. The thing is, you get rid of Skubal, you get Ryan, you get something else too. You get something that's more helpful for the offense. And then you
hope Ryan has a season as good as Skubal's having.
Yeah, you got 7 years or whatever it is.
Like, the White Sox and Crochet, I understand, because you're not going to be competitive for 2 years.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah,
you're probably there.
Maybe that's what it is instead. Yeah, it's very fair.
I don't know.
It's just that the price is never going to be as high as it is now for Skubal. And I'm very much of like, I think teams give themselves too much of a benefit for what their window is. And do you want something that is like, okay, they're not gonna win the World Series this year. They probably aren't gonna win it next year. And so you're doing it for 1 year for Skubal. And for that 1 year going after that, you could establish a foundation that is, I think, stronger for longer. But I mean, that's just me. I'm just being
I get it.
I'm playing fantasy baseball here, guys.
It
depends obviously on what the deal is and all that kind
of
stuff. All right.
Of course.
We've got a couple things here. I love the last one. I'm just gonna tell you right now. The last one you have listed here, tell us what that is. I think you're completely right. Oh yeah,
this kind of relates to River a bit. It's just everyone needs more pitches.
Yeah.
I think I'm generally of the idea that you can just give guys more pitches in the minors, especially, and I think the Dodgers are one of the teams that is more comfortable doing this.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I see a lot of teams with guys in the minors like not actually developing mixes, and then they get to the majors and then it's like, oh, now you failed. Like, now we'll give you the pitches that you need to go back down to AAA and figure them out, you know?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
I generally don't think, and again, I've never been in a major league where I've never developed pitchers. I don't necessarily know what is best. And I imagine you can yip guys up doing this, but like, I just want you throwing 4 to 5 pitches, 4 to 6 pitches. Like, give me, if you're like sink slide, like, I need four, I need cut, I need curve to lefties. I need you going 5-15% of the time in the minors. We figure out which one of those is good. Like, this gets back to the point of like, teams are risk averse. Like, on the guy that's a 4-5, you know, we're not going to make changes there because we're concerned he turns into a 5 without considering the fact that he could turn into a 3-8 and be really good. This applies to stuff like this. Like, you have guys in the minors perhaps that are good at, performing well, and whether they're agent or someone else is like, we don't want that guy doing anything. Like, he's got a 3-2 in 100 innings in Double A. And it's like, I don't care. Nothing he's throwing right now is going to make him a major leaguer.
Right,
you know?
Exactly.
It's like, he's going to get pounded. Like, he needs 3 more pitches for lefties. Like, his splits are already bad. He's allowing like a 450 slug of lefties. How is he not throwing 4+ pitches there? You know, like, that general thinking is something that I think needs to be embraced more.
Yep.
And I just, there's multiple orgs I see with certain guys. Like Jose Soriano is a good one. Like, that dude's, his stuff is insane. He has we're at like 100 inning sample of him zoning his curve as much as he's zoning his sinker. And the Angels insist on him throwing like 60% sinker and backing off other pitches. And it's like, no, don't do that.
Yeah. that curve is really like good. The moneymaker for him. And then the sinker doesn't even get strikes all the time.
So it's like, drop the sinker to 40%. Like, give me that weird splinker thing he's throwing. Like, you can figure out the bullet slider there. He throws that thing like 89. It's like, I need more pitches there. And it's the whole point of like, he's having success, so they're never going to do that, right?
Yep.
But if I'm trying to set him up to be good in a couple of years, I'd almost argue it's more valuable for him to figure out his mix and distribution now than it is to like have success on a team that is terrible with 60% sinker now in the last month, you know? It frustrates me a little bit sometimes.
Oh, it's so frustrating too. I talked about this before. What is the process in between games? What is the development actually like? I'm very much of someone who experimented a ton, and I think that canvas is so important. There are risks of changing arm angles and changing feel, which then you add the cutter that makes your four seamer worse, etc. But I'm very much like, you have to try all the things. Like, I don't understand why there isn't just like a tome for every team that's like, this is all the grips. Just try all of them. This is your month of like going through and finding the ones that you like and just taking one bullpen for this one. Cool. If I figure out, figure the one that you like, get the video of it, get the rep soda, be like, cool, this got this, this got this. That's the one for this one. Next, we'll go to the sliders. Okay, we go through the, you know, like just, you have to do that. And it's like, wait, hold on a second. You're saying that you only need a month to like do of a workout to figure out what you have and what you don't have, like what you could work. Like, yeah, that's it. That's like, that's it. You know, it's pretty wild to me how we think about minor league is, well, no, you have to pitch every 5 days. You got to do that. That's the only way to do it. It's like, no, it's not. You can do whatever the heck you want on that team.
Yeah.
It really doesn't matter. So there's a lot of that stuff I think gets overlooked. We're out of time, Lance. I am so sorry.
Yeah.
You have some really interesting with ones here also about understanding decay and buyback. And then pretty much
we didn't get into that's a whole podcast though.
I mean, that's what you're talking about, like rest and recovery, correct?
No, I'm talking about so that is purely like batter versus pitcher within individual game.
Oh, I see. Oh man,
like, I throw a pitch a ton.
We're bringing you back on for that.
Where's that point where it drops?
100%. Oh, I love that conversation, guys. Lance Brzezowski, guys, if you're not following him, I don't know what you're doing. He's doing unbelievable work, Lance. Tell everybody actually what you're doing for the next week, month. What's ahead for you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just pushing YouTube and Substack, really making some videos and continuing to write up pitchers. Nothing too huge.
Yeah, man, it's the only life. It's the best live pitchers. Don't talk about it here. Who cares? I know. Only pitchers. No, really, guys. Lance is the best. And Lance, thank you so much for joining today.
Always, man. Thanks for letting me fill in.
Of course. On behalf of Lance Brzezowski, my name is Nick Pollock, and we'll talk again about the craft of pitching next week.